Introduce our speaker for this morning. It's from Long Beach, California, Johnny Harris.
Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here today, and I'm glad to be sober, just to be sober. You know, when I was sitting back there listening to the lieutenant talk, and somebody asked him a question why he hadn't been cleared to go in on a panel because he had a felony conviction. And the lieutenant answered, I don't know whether I got it straight or not, he answered it, it's a law that ex-felons can't carry messages into institution. If that law had been in effect 30 and a half years ago, I'd be dead now. Because I'm alive and well because the institution that I was sitting in allowed a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to come in and carry the message to me. I think the most important thing is that we get to go. I had the message brought to me by a member of an institutional committee and a little over 30 years ago. And from my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to this instant, I haven't had anything of a chemical nature running in and out of my system. And I don't know if that makes it any particularly wonderful thing, because I haven't had a drink or a pill or smoked any grass or stuck any needles in my arm from the fourth day of November 1959 to this moment. But I do know the reason for it, and I do know that because the people who came into that institution and carried the message to me wore this program in such a package that I would have died and went to hell for a piece of the ribbon that it was wrapped in. And I didn't have the slightest idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was when I sat in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Matter of fact, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was almost my last meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary a long, long time ago, and the people of Alcoholics Anonymous talked to me about being sober. And I didn't think Alcoholics Anonymous had anything to offer me, because I was as physically sober when I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as I am right now, as physically sober. And all my life, people have been telling me not to drink and I'd be okay. You know, I have been sober from my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to this one. And when I think about being sober, and I think about being sober a lot, the idea that there's no alcohol or chemicals running in and out of my system doesn't even enter into the picture. See, being sober to me is the way I live. I lived a certain way for a long period of time, and for a long period of time I couldn't stay sober. I have lived an entirely different way for a long period of time, and all that period of time hasn't been necessary for me to drink anything, swallow anything, smoke anything, or stick anything in my arm. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. I'm very pleased to be here this morning, fully clothed and in my right mind. And I tell you that because a little over 31 years ago today, I was crawling around on my knees in a cell in solitary confinement in a maximum security penitentiary bargain at the moon. Because of a loving God has expressed himself through a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, it's no longer necessary for me to crawl around on my hands and knees like an animal. If I got nothing else out of this deal at all, I guess I could live with that for a long time. Makes me feel good. I'd like to be able to stand here today and to tell you or anybody else who would listen to me and go along with the theme of things in the world that's where alcohol and drugs took me to. See, I'd like to be able to blame it on that, but you see, that's where I took me to. The only thing that alcohol and drugs did in my life, they kept me alive long enough to find Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all. I'm as sure as I'm standing here without alcohol working in my life, I'd have blown my brains out before I was 9 years old. I've always been an emotional misfit. I never belonged anywhere. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I was angry, hostile, bitter, and violent. And I had a rotten attitude. Now, you don't need much more than that. I haven't even had a drink yet, for God's sake. That's the way I live. I don't know why that was. I don't even know where it came from. That's just the way I always felt. I didn't like anything or anybody. Matter of fact, I was just burning up with hatred. I didn't like anything. I didn't like my deal, my situation. And that, I've come to understand, is a real good indication of self-centeredness. I wouldn't want to throw you anything too heavy out there, but that's the way I lived all my life, concerned about me. I look around at my family. I had a family. All my family were drinkers. Everybody in my family drank whiskey. They made whiskey, and they drank whiskey, and they sold whiskey. I saw what whiskey did to people. I said to myself, I was never going to drink. I'm not going to be like those people. I watched them drink. I watched my uncles drink and go to penitentiaries. I watched my aunts drink and work in those houses on the other side of the tracks. I watched my old man drink and beat up my mother. I watched my mother drink and beat up my old man. Watched them both drink and beat me up. I watched all that kind of stuff. I'm not going to drink, I said to myself. But one day, out of curiosity, I took a drink of alcohol. I just took a drink. I did something I said I'd never do. That was my first selling out point, I think. And what happened to me in that instant was that I sold my soul into bondage for the next 20 years of my life. A bondage that would take me into the gates of insanity and death and beyond. Pursuing a feeling that I got when I drank. Not alcohol, or later the drugs that came into my life. The feeling I got when I drank alcohol. That feeling went down inside of me and stilled the screaming madness and took me from the black pit of nothingness, stood me into the gray fringes of the business of living, and installed in me some type of arrogance, said, damn you, world, it's all right. I'm not good enough to be around the good people, but I'm too good to be around the bad people. It's okay right here. So alcohol did for me. And when I drank, every time I drank, for the next 20 years, the same thing happened to me. I took a drink of alcohol, and 3 days later, they pulled me out from underneath a bridge and stood me in front of a judge and sent me to the Hutchinson State Reform School. 20 years later, I took a drink of alcohol. They pulled me out of a car in Compton, stood me in front of a judge and sent me to 20 years in the penitentiary. That's what happened to me when I drank. I got drunk and went places. I just traveled around out there. I went from reform school to junior penitentiaries to penitentiaries to nut houses. Nut houses. Now they call them treatment centers. They still wrap you up there because they come from a funny farm, baby. It doesn't make any difference to you. I just tell you that it worked. That's all. I don't know anything about that. I remember sitting on a furlough from a reform school when I'm 10 or 11 years old. I'm drinking a bottle of Marco Petri red wine, which was my drink. See, I start on wine and work down. And I drank this Marco Petri red wine, and probably most of you don't even know what Marco Petri red wine is. Marco Petri red wine was the experimental stages of Thunderbird. That stuff was so bad, they almost had to hold a gun on you to drink it. Not very long ago, well, I guess it's been a little while ago now, I was at a restaurant in Palm Springs, and I was having dinner. It was a real nice restaurant with some friends. We were having dinner, and there was a wine steward over there. And I called him over. And I said to him, have you ever heard of Marco Petri red wine? He looked at me kind of funny, and he said, yeah, but I never knew anybody who ever lived to drink it. And I said to him, I used to drink it by the gallon. He said, sure you did. And he went over and stood in the corner, and all evening, every once in a while, I'd look over there and see him watching me. And when I knew he had his gaze fixed on me, I did that a couple times, right? But I'm sitting on this street corner of this institution, and see, I never had any trouble in institution. I lived very well in institution. I play baseball when I'm locked up, and I stand around and be cool. And you don't need much more than that. Just wait. Somebody rings a bell, I do something. They don't ring a bell, I don't do nothing. I just stand around and wait. Nobody says, what are you waiting for? It's just waiting. Something to do in there, just wait. Just lean up against the wall, play dominoes. I had a hell of a time going there. Wait for somebody to get them, come in and get me loaded. But I was in this reform school, and they had a deal there where they, or this boys' home in the San Fernando Valley, and they let us out on a home trip once a week, and see, once a month. And I was all right my first week back in school. I was, like most people when they get locked up, I was a scholar. I read inspirational books. I was an athlete. I took strenuous exercise. See, my third week in this institution, the madness set in because I started to think. I started to think about showing up in the neighborhood, and my gang wanted me to be their leader. I don't want to be their leader. I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an architect, an engineer. I don't know. I don't want to be their leader. I want to play baseball. That's what I want to do. I want to be a Major League Baseball player. That's what I want to be. But you see, I don't know how to handle these guys. I don't know how to walk up to these guys. I'm scared, I'm frightened, I don't know how to tell them anything. And I try to think out what's the answer to this situation I don't understand, and the answer comes with a bottle of Marco Petri red wine. So I sit around and think about taking that drink and to relieve the anxiety and the madness that's going on inside of me. And one day I sit down on the street corner with a gallon of Marco Petri red wine. I drank the whole gallon. I'm sober as I am right now. I'm frightened to death because my magic's not magic anymore. And I don't know what to do about that. And the guy come along and tapped me on the shoulder and said, why don't you try these? And he gave me some pills. I don't remember saying to him, what are those? Do you think they'll bother me if I take them? I just took them. All I can tell you is thank God they weren't X-lax. That's all I can tell you. We could have a whole new 12-step program in an institution called Laxatives Anonymous, I guess. I could be standing here today as an adult child of a laxative taker. I would have been functional, but Mother sat on the toilet all the time when I was little. Stupider things than that going on around here. I can tell you they work. I'm sitting on that same street corner on a furlough from another reform school a few years later, and I'm eating pills and I'm drinking wine and nothing's working, and a guy stuck a needle in my arm. And for the next 14 years of my life, I stuck needles in my arm, ran in and out of institutions. That's what I do. I run the streets, and I take, and I use, and I abuse. If you have something I want, I take it. I can't possibly remember in my lifetime when I took my inventory. I couldn't possibly remember in my lifetime ever having a conscious thought or a conscious concern for any other human being who lived upon the face of this earth. I was only interested in me and my own well-being. I was only interested in getting loaded or getting the money to get loaded on. I wasn't worried about the consequences. The consequences be damned. The consequences weren't half as bad for getting loaded as they were for not getting loaded. And I didn't understand what was going on. I wandered through life with a long path of destruction about me. And in 1951, on my way to the penitentiary for the first time, I stood in the old Los Angeles County Jail, and my mother screamed at me through the vision screen that I was a murderer. It seemed that my 17-year-old brother had gotten into some of my poison, took an overdose of it, and died. I didn't know how to handle that. I handled like I handled most things. I got mad at it, made it go away. 3 days later, I stood handcuffed between two detectives out underneath a tree while they buried my baby brother. And I got all the guilt and shame and humiliation and degradation of a lifetime hanging around my shoulders, and I wanted to cry, but I didn't know how. I didn't have the simple gift of tears that God gives every creature that's born on the face of this earth, and the reason I didn't have them is because I didn't think they were necessary. I went on to the penitentiary and I stayed there 4.5 years. I came out of there 4.5 years sicker than I was when I went in there. Because my disease doesn't get any better just because I don't drink. My disease gets worse during the passage of time. Even during long total periods of absence, I get worse. Worse and worse and worse. It doesn't get any better. I come walking out of that institution bound to determine what a psychiatrist of San Quentin told me wasn't true. He told me people like me didn't change. He said, Johnny, you're doomed to die in an institution. He took me down and showed me a little green room. He says, you're going to end up here, hotshot. And I told him, not me, I'm different. I come walking out of the institution bound to turn and prove that. And 6 months later, I'm laying in a nut house kicking and screaming. And that's when I made my round to some of the better laughing academies in the country interviewing psychiatrists. I had to sit around with my wraparound overcoat on and talk to them. They'd talk to me about my mother, and I'd talk to them about their mother. And that's when they introduced me to a thing called better living through electricity. It's wonderful. I'll tell you one thing, if anything goes wrong with this microphone, I won't touch it. I don't touch anything that has electrical currents in it. I'm even leery about turning on my car sometimes. What I hope and pray to God is my last interview with psychiatrists. It took place in a federal government hospital in Fort Worth, Texas, 32 years ago, somewhere around there. I remember moving in and sit down at this man's desk, looking up against his desk, looked up against the wall, and looking at all of his plaques and his diplomas and his degrees, and I thought maybe he knows something because he had all those plaques up there. I remember sitting there with great anticipation because this is where it ended. Everything else is wrong. See, I got a problem. I got a real problem. I still feel the way I'd always felt, and I can't turn my head off anymore. I can't get the magic that I'm putting inside of my system. No matter what I put inside of my system, I can't make me go away anymore. I'm in a lot of trouble. And that doctor looked at me that day and he said, Johnny, if you didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, you wouldn't have any problems. When I was a kid in the Hutchinson State Reform School, my counselor told me if I didn't drink, I'd be all right. When I was in juvenile hall in Los Angeles, my counselor told me if I didn't drink, I'd be all right. When I was in Whittier State Reform School, my counselor told me if I didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, I'd be all right. When I was Preston School for Boys, Pacific Lodge Boys Home, when I was in San Quentin, people told me if I didn't drink these things and swallow these things and smoke these things and shoot these things, I'd be all right. What none of those people ever take into consideration, and I doubt if they ever still take anything into consideration, I said, every time they told me that, I was as physically sober as I am right now. How many times I wanted to scream out at them, good God, don't you understand? Don't you understand? Make it 1950 again. I won't do this anymore. Bring back my baby brother. Let me get in that grave. I won't do this anymore. But I didn't know that. I hadn't been here. So I went on down that road of busted dreams and fantasies. And a little over 32 years ago, they tied me down the bed in the old Los Angeles County Jail one more time, more dead than alive. I weighed 128 pounds, and I was yellow, and I was having a medical doctor tend to put in my bed telling me I was going to die. His words were to me this, son, you're going to die, and there's nothing we can do for you. Because you see, in my day, I don't know about today, but in my day, it was absolutely and totally forbidden by law to administer any type of medication or treatment to a drug addict. Any kind. If you had a narcotic record, they didn't treat you. If you died, their big joke was, if you're laying down on that concrete floor, if you live long enough, we'll take you to court. That's real hilarious when you're puking up that green vial, I'll tell you that. Do you want to die? That's the way I got sober. I got sober laying on a concrete floor in the Los Angeles County Jail. And I'm not so sure that that's the wrong way to do it anymore. I'm really not so sure that's not the right way to do it. Worked for me. I only know that I laid in my deathbed for 18 days and 18 nights, and I didn't eat, sleep, drink, or do anything. I just laid there. And one night, because I knew nothing better to do, I screamed out the only prayer I'd ever said in my life. I said, oh, God, help me. I thought for a long time that nothing had happened. There was no blinding flashes of light. Nobody come running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, we got an AA meeting down there. I didn't get up and wander off into the tulip somewhere. I just went to sleep for a little while, and I don't know how many of you ever kicked a two-year heroin habit, but that's what I was doing. That's the first time I'd been asleep in a long time. I tell you how sick I was. 2 short weeks later, I'm up running around the jail looking for some more of the poison to put me back on the bed I just gotten off of. And there's a very good reason for that, because the problem, which is centered in the back of my mind, there was a knowledge that once upon a time when I could not stand it any longer, I could ingest something into my system and it'd be okay for just a little while. Just a little while. Right now, that's all I ever wanted, but just at all right now. And even though this stuff wasn't working, and I knew it wasn't working anymore, I knew it would if I could just find the right combination of things. So I got loaded again. I stood in front of a Superior Court judge and was told exactly what I was. I was called a blood-sucking parasite in society. The man said I didn't have any right being around decent people. He told a woman sitting in the courtroom who was carrying my oldest daughter, if you care anything at all about that child, you'll never allow her to lay eyes on this scum again. And what that man said to me that day wasn't anything new to me. That's something I'd known all my life. See, I have never been able to hide me from me yesterday, today, or tomorrow. I've always been aware of what I am. I've always, through sober eyes, been able to look at the long line of destruction that's mine, that I created. There's the busted dreams and fantasies and broken people and death and all that nonsense that went into my way of living. There's a path of it right there when I'm cold sober. And I can't stand that. I know I created it. And what happens to people like me happened to people like me, because my brain exploded that day in that courtroom when I was faced with the truth. Not only was I faced with the truth, I heard the truth for the first time in my life. Somewhere in a good book, it says, know the truth and the truth will set you free. That day I was set free because my brain exploded, and for the next 9 months of my life I crawled in and out of a cell in solitary confinement, drifting in and out of total insanity. I'd come to out of one of those insane blackouts of mine, scraping my food down off the wall where I'd thrown it up in an insane rage. And that's what wandered into his meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the fourth day of November 1959. That's what came into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come here to get sober. I was sober. I believe that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous my first time to find another group of people to hate, because I'd run out of people. There wasn't any. I wandered in and I sat in the back row of this institution. I came to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because the institution I was in let women come in there. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous over 30 years ago to smell perfume. And I've been honking and sniffing around here ever since. I don't care about what gets them in here. I don't know. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I moved in and sit down in the back row like all newcomers do. Hell, I didn't want to sit up in front. Somebody might mistake me for an A member or something, for God's sake. Sat back there in the back row with my coat collar up and my shades on because I was cool. If I'd have been any cooler when I got here, I'd have froze to death, for God's sake. I remember looking up on the backboard. I saw two big gates, and I thought to myself, my God, I've wandered into an anti-aircraft brigade. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I said to this clown, what is this? He said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I sunk down in my seat. Gangsters weren't supposed to be hanging out with them winos. Been Gangsters Anonymous or Over-Hip Anonymous or Dope Fiends Anonymous. God, ain't that macho? You get your teeth in, make addicts seem kind of candy-ass, doesn't it? Just dope fiends. Be bad, act bad, smell bad, talk bad. Die bad. I thought I'd wait for these women to get up and tell their racy stories. Now, you got to remember, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there weren't very many young, pretty girls in Alcoholics Anonymous. These old gals got up to talk that day, and they said they drank for a long time. You could look at them and know they'd been somewhere for a long time. They said, I used to drink. I said, I'll bet you did. Bad stuff, too. You can tell. I mean, people in the back row know everything. They all know everything. They don't know how to stay sober, but they know everything else. They're dying by degree, but they got all the answers for living. They wrote a paragraph in them at the tail end of a spiritual experience in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They wrote a paragraph for people like me. So there's a principle which is a boon to mankind, which is bound to keep him in an everlasting ignorance. That is a principle of contempt prior to investigation. I lived my entire lifetime like that. And that's the way I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with this thing. I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. People got up here and talked about God. I got up and walked out of the room. I wasn't going to listen to this God business. God was the reason I was. It wasn't my fault. I had a guy tell me one day, not very long ago in a meeting, he says, you're not going to talk about God, are you? And I said, yes, I am. He said, oh, you shouldn't do that. People are sensitive in Alcoholics Anonymous today. You may run them out of here. Well, let me tell you something, if there's anybody new. If God will run you out of Alcoholics Anonymous, whiskey will run your rusty butt back in here. That seems to be a load leveler for most things. I kept coming back because I found out there was a different group of people coming up there. I kept coming back. They kept talking about God, and I kept leaving. And one day I got up and I went and sat on this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a little guy that I knew did 23 flat years in the penitentiary, used to be my baseball coach in San Quentin, stood at a podium very much like this and told me something that all the great learned people that I met in my life didn't seem to know. He told me I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. He says, you don't have to do it like this no more. And nobody had ever told me that. After the meeting, I went up to him. I said, how do you learn how to live? That's all I want to know. I just want to know how to live with this insanity that I can't get rid of anymore. He looked at me and he said, Johnny, there's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in the library. If you go get it, I'll go home and pray that you find some part of you in it. I guess he prayed real hard, that little fella, because I've been a student of the book Alcoholics Anonymous from that day to this day. And the only thing I've ever found in that book is me. I haven't looked for anything else. I'm not looking for a way to sober up the world or cure all of society's ills. I'm looking for a way to live peacefully and comfortably and joyously with me and the loving God that made me. The strange phenomena that take place in my life is the closer I adhere to the principles that are written in that book and the more willing I become to share that knowledge in this fellowship just for the sheer joy of doing it, the more peaceful and the more comfortable and the more joyous I live with me and the loving God that made me. I had a lot of trouble when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand what was going on here. I was totally confused in A when I got here. In the first place, I was an alcoholic. Then I didn't understand what was going on. I had people get up at podiums like this and say, I used to drink. Now I don't drink anymore, and everything is wonderful. I said, I guess I'm not alcoholic then. I'm as physically sober as you are, Buster, and I'm crazy. So I can't. It's logical, isn't it? Alcoholics are full of logic. It's logical. I'm not drinking. You're not drinking, you're fine. I'm not drinking, I'm crazy. I can't be an alcoholic. Then they'd say, you got to get active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got up and run around like a chicken with my head cut off. I picked up ashtrays, poured coffee, smiled at people. Wonderful here in AA. You keep coming back, you newcomers, you'll be wonderful like all the rest of us are. Then I went back and set an inventory point and died. I was doing everything they told me to do, and I'm crazy. I don't know what's going on. And every time I ask one of these people about it, they say to me, it's in the book, Johnny. I'd say, what's in the book? They say, well, it's there. If you go get it, you'll find out what it is. And I didn't understand what they were talking about. I went and looked at their book one day, and I'm laying in my cell, and I read that book, and I picked it up, and I threw it across the cell. I fell on the floor, and I screamed out my madness, I'm different. This thing won't work for me. I went over and picked it up and looked down and saw the most simple statement I'd ever seen in my life. It said, how it works. I want you to know I almost missed that. I was sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a period of time, listening to the fifth chapter read time and time and time again, and I didn't know how it worked. I guess I was too busy jockeying for position or looking for coffee or trying to see who knew I was there or what was going on or hiding or whatever I was doing. But I guess when you can hear, and when you can see, and there's not much you can do about it. I guess that's just the way it is. I don't know why it is, but that's just the way it is. I don't make the rules, I just live by them. I only know that day I saw it. I saw right behind that who makes our program and who doesn't and why not. There's no great mystery to me about who stays sober in Alcoholics Anonymous anymore. The mystery's taken out of it in the first chapter, the first paragraph of chapter 5 of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, period. It doesn't say this simple program in anything. It just says this simple program. And somehow or other, through no strange hook or crook on my own, I got into a program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous while confined in an institution. I had plenty of time. I didn't have anything to do. Baseball season hadn't started yet. So I started trying to fulfill conditions of a program of recovery, not to prove that it would work, but to prove that it wouldn't work, because my case was different. And I was going to prove to you I could work your steps and it wouldn't work. And the most single important event in my entire lifetime, up until this very instant, happened to me one day sitting in a room with a man doing what the program of recovery says I must do. He said I had to take a fifth step. And sitting in this room with this man, I spent 3.5 hours telling him about every rotten, filthy, corruptible thing I'd ever done. And somewhere during that time with that man, I heard myself admit to him that I was an alcoholic. From way down deep inside of me, there came a freedom with me that day that I carry with me to this very instant. Because, you see, as I stand here today, I know exactly what's wrong with me. I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from a disease called alcoholism. I'm not an alcoholic and anything. When I was an alcoholic and something, I separated myself from you and couldn't have what you had. I couldn't have your simple program. See, when I became an alcoholic just like you, I was given the simple program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I have to do what the alcoholics have to do. I can't be special or different or above or below. I just got to be like all the rest of the drunks. The most important person in Alcoholics Anonymous I found is the coffee maker. You don't believe that? You show up at a meeting some night when the coffee's not made. The goddamn secretary will get strangled. But they'll look for a coffee maker. I insult people sometimes by telling them that. What do you mean the coffee maker's the most important? What about me? And I say, you're not important. I'll tell you how important most of us are. If you, in my home group that I go to on Monday night, there's 200 or 300 people in that meeting. And if somebody doesn't get there and save his seat's taken, no matter who he is. That's how important you are. There's nothing anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous does that somebody else can't do. If there's a job in Alcoholics Anonymous that an alcoholic can't do, then we ought to not have the job. That's very simple. An alcoholic is just a person who has an abnormal reaction to alcohol. That's what an alcoholic is. I thought an alcoholic for a long time was a drinker, somebody who drank whiskey. I thought my dad was an alcoholic. My dad lived till he was 89 years old. He never quit drinking. Hell, he retired from 2 jobs. He went on about his business. He was a derelict when he died, but I can't say he was an alcoholic. My mother's 85. She's still drinking whiskey out of a bottle. Now she's getting some help from one of them doctors, so she's really having a hell of a time with some of them pocket rockets, I'll tell you that. Mama, the doctors are helping Mom with her whiskey drinking. She doesn't even know where she's at half the time. All kinds of strange things started to happen to me after I admitted that I was an alcoholic and became willing to do everything that it says to do in this program of recovery. I had people come into my life who had no right coming into my life. Along about that time in my life, my vocabulary consisted of about four-letter words. Mother ran all around it in there. It was a trigger that made everything go. Some guys sent me down in a room, and they word-by-word, sentence-by-sentence, paragraph-by-paragraph fed me the English language. They told me things like cussing was a crutch for conversational cripples. Then they stood my wrath when they rained on me. And I got mad at them and jumped on them and hollered at them and screamed at them. How dare they correct me? I've come to understand a very, very simple truth, that love is correction. To love somebody is to correct them. That's what love is. Love is correction. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous really is. Alcoholics Anonymous is permeated with the atmosphere of love. It gives us a way to live comfortably enough where I do not have to drink alcohol today. That's why I'm sober. I'm sober because I found a way to live out there with my unsolved problem. I've had a way to clear out the wreckage of the past and to have a primary purpose in life. My primary purpose in life is to stay sober. That's my primary. I don't have any other purpose in life. I just want to stay sober. I'll tell you, all kinds of strange things happen to people in institutions. If you've been raised in one of those institutions, you started off in juvenile hall and went all the way through till you hit the College of Higher Knowledge in San Quentin. And you're a big-time baseball player, and you're a big-time dope fiend, a big-time dope dealer, and a big-time convict. And all of a sudden, you put a book called Alcoholics Anonymous in your arm and start walking around a yard. You become a lot of strange things. You become things like Holy Joe and Jerusalem Slim, the captain's boy. And for a long, long time, I thought I had to defend Alcoholics Anonymous and my actions in it, so I had to go fight for a while. I said, well, you don't understand. I'm just gaming and carrying on. Until I finally turned around and looked at them donkeys who were making fun of me. They were sitting in there. And every once in a while, when I quit fighting them, one of my old partners would come out of the back and walk up to me and say, maybe, Johnny, maybe one of us can make it. I'm going to tell you about a startling statistic. It's the only statistic I've ever made, I've ever kept track of. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's 147 convicts in that room. I'm the only one who stayed sober. I'm the only one who stayed sober in that whole 147 people. Now, that doesn't make me special. Doesn't make me wonderful. The reason I'm sober today is because I surrendered to this simple program called Alcoholics Anonymous and became willing to do what it says for me to do here. That's all. I turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him, and God as I understood Him for a long time was my sponsor. I didn't have the ability to believe in a supreme being when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My God today is a byproduct of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all. I only know that on the fourth day of June, 1961, they opened up the doors of the penitentiary and let me out. I got into a world I didn't know anything about. The only thing I was armed with was the knowledge and the freedom that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had given me in an institution a year before that. I only knew, I only had one idea, that somewhere they let me go sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all I wanted to do. All I wanted to do was just go sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, God, if they would just give me the privilege of sitting there. See, I think it's a privilege to be here. I don't think I have a right to come and occupy spaces in Alcoholics Anonymous because I don't drink. I think that's an ego trip. I don't have rights. I have privileges. I'm privileged to go sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and to carry the message of life to people who are dying. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is to me. And I do it at every time, every opportunity I get. I always have. I just love shouting the good news. I just do. And the good news is that Alcoholics Anonymous works. It works real well. Because I've been functioning out in that world out there that I don't know anything about for almost 29 years now. I came out of that penitentiary. I went home to see my mother, and my mother fell off the steps blind drunk. I picked her up and put her on the couch and said, Mom, I'm going to an AA meeting. She said, fine, I think you should. I learned a great lesson from my mother. I learned I don't have the power to get anybody sober. I don't have the power to get them drunk either. I don't even have any power to keep me sober. I'm not responsible for anybody else. I'm not even responsible for me. I just go around and do what I'm supposed to do and do what I'm asked to do, and something happens to me. I'm given a power to stay sober one day. This is the day I get to stay sober. I don't get to stay sober because I've been sober. That's another misnomer around here. I don't get to stay sober because I've been sober. That I've been doing this stuff for years. I get to stay sober because I would come to Fresno and share my experience, strength, and hope. That tonight I get to go to another meeting and share my experience, strength, and hope. The last night I was in a meeting sharing my experience, strength, and hope. This is the day I get to stay sober. I didn't know that. My sponsor made me go to work when I came out of the penitentiary. He said to me, you got to go to work. I said, what? He said, work. W-O-R-K, work. I didn't know why I should work. I was sober, wasn't I? Somebody ought to take care of me because I'm sober. My wife is back. She's got that little girl I was never supposed to see, and she's pregnant. She's getting tired of eating those stale donuts I was bringing home from meetings. But I was doing real well. My sponsor got me a job working in the oil fields. I remember showing up on my first day at work. And the guy asked me a dumb question. He said, what's your Social Security card number? I said, what's that? He said, you don't have a Social Security card, Johnny? And I said, no, I don't. He said, how old are you? I said, I'm 30. He said, you don't have a Social Security card? And I said, no. He said, why not? I said, I've never needed one. He said, where have you been all these years? I said, you wouldn't understand if I told you, mister. You know what he did? He took me down and got me a Social Security card and put me to work. So I couldn't go home and snivel to my sponsor that they weren't hiring ex-convicts anymore. Go down and sit down in the club and have a cup of coffee. Talk that trash about how they ain't hiring ex-convicts out there. We're being discriminated against. To work. Somebody stole my first paycheck. You want to hear somebody scream? Listen to a thief when they get stolen from. Tell you a story about my first paycheck. I didn't know what people do when they get paid. What the hell people do when they get paid? I never got paid before. I stole everything I needed. You had something, I just took it from you. Got a paycheck. I used to help when I stand off in the corner somewhere and watch people in markets. You know what they do? They go put kids in them baskets and push them down the aisles and fill them full of groceries. The guy goes into shock when they get to that cash register. We don't really need all that stuff, do we? I got a paycheck. I ran home. I said, let's go to the market. She said, what for? And I said, that's what they do when they get paid. She said, who? And I said, them. You ever tried to explain them to them? They look at you kind of crazy. I guess I had one of them spiritual looks that all newcomers have. You know, we're going to the market, you bitch, or I'm going to kill you. You know what I mean? We went down to the market. I put the kid around there, and about an hour later, I went to ask her for some money, and somebody stole her purse. I'm going to tell you something. If I could have found that guy, you'd have another talker here this afternoon. I'd be over there in Folsom telling you that AA don't work with all the rest of the losers. That's the only people that ever tell you AA don't work is losers. People stand at podiums like this and say AA ain't enough. I'm going to tell you, anybody tells me that, I got one thought goes to my mind. Anybody ever stand here and tells me that AA ain't enough? They never tried AA. It's always been enough for me. See, I have papers in Sacramento that's in a closed file that says I'm permanently and totally insane. That I have a criminal mind and I'll never be allowed to live on the streets over a period of time. That I will go literally insane and die in an institution. I have papers from some of the leading psychiatrists in this country for that fact. And yet, I stand here before you today, fully clothed in my right mind. I work for a living. I'm married. My two daughters are grown. My oldest daughter has three of the prettiest little grandsons you've ever seen. And I have everything in life that a man could possibly ever want. And I have never been anywhere or done anything else to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. See, Alcoholics Anonymous is not my occupation. It's my advocation. I work for a living. I think for me to sell this thing would be to some type of tarnish my gift. some type of a sickness to do that. I do this for free and for fun, because it's the only salvation I have. Without Alcoholics Anonymous and my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll sicken and die. I still have to go to 5 or 6 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week. I still have to go and do whatever I had to do. But I got into a trap when I came out of the penitentiary. And I hope there's nobody in this group, and there usually is in all the hospital and institutional committees I go to. I got into a trap. I got to thinking that I'm carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to be Mr. Institutional Committee. I got to go on panels and panels and panels and chairmanships of panels and panels. And I had turned around one day and hadn't been to an AA meeting for 2 years. Oh, I've been to a lot of panels and a lot of institutions, but I'm talking about an AA meeting. And I went up to this old guy who founded the Hospital and Institutional Committees in Los Angeles, a guy by the name of Jack Prose. And I said to Jack, I got to give up my panels. He said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to go back and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, you can't do that. I said, you watch me. And I went back and sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to soak up the love and listen for a while. Because I got into a trap where I'd drive 500 miles to talk, but I wouldn't walk across the street to listen. There's a lot of people like that. I got in a trap. I got to thinking that the Hospital and Institutional Committee was Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's not Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into that trap. If it hadn't been for my sponsor, I'd have probably died out there. My ego got so inflamed that I became an authority on what went on in institutions. I kept my panel in Terminal Island for over 12 years. I kept that panel out there. And I still go out there. I still go wherever I'm asked to go. I do whatever I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I don't limit it to one simple little activity. It's everything. It's the whole picture. Is it any more spiritual? Would it be any more spiritual to make coffee in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit down and talk to a newcomer than to go to some institution and spread the word? Is that any more spiritual? I don't think so. How could one meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous be any more spiritual than another? I damn near died into that trap. I love hospital and institutional work. Matter of fact, my ex-wife is the one who started the first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in a Navy base in Terminal Island. And from that stemmed the whole Armed Forces Alcoholism program, and we had to fight to get that in there. We had a psychiatrist who didn't think that Alcoholics Anonymous would work until he saw 4 or 5 sailors sober. And then he got the brilliant idea, like a lot of administrators. He knew something would work, but he'd think he ought to add something to it, so he stuck an anti-abuse program in there. And he retired from the Navy and went on to a big hospital job somewhere else, spreading the illness. Alcoholics Anonymous is plenty. I wouldn't go anywhere I wasn't wanted. I'll tell you one thing that I found out about institutions. I don't know whether it's like up in Northern California. I do know that a friend of mine in Northern California from the San Francisco Bay Area wrote most of the policies and procedures for the Northern California Institutional Committees. Laid out the foundation of it. And we copied a lot of it in Southern California when he wrote it. Grand old man. But I'll tell you what I see in institutions. You know, we had a meeting that we were holding in a hospital on a Saturday night. And I went over that meeting one night, and we were having this meeting, and they brought the patients in and set them down over the side with their counselor. And they wouldn't let us talk to them. They would let us talk to them. So we decided we weren't having a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in there, so we took our meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous out of there and moved it somewhere else. If you can't talk to the people about Alcoholics Anonymous, what good is it? If we're going into institutions and they're dictating the policy to what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, then we shouldn't be in there. We shouldn't be in there. Who do we think we are? God? That we're going to be the ones who save souls? What kind of an ego trip is that? Kind of an ego trip is to think that we're the only people who know what's going on. I'm not going to do it. I think we defeat our own purposes. They've watered down Alcoholics Anonymous so much in some of those institutions that you don't even know whether you're in an AA meeting or not. They read the policy here today. I listened to the policy it's read. It says the message is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. It doesn't say to the substance abuse. What's substance abuse mean? Drank too much coffee? Ate too many candies? I don't know. I only know that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know that all these things are important. And I do know another thing that I used to do when I went into institutions, which I thought was really kind of cute at the time, but I found out it's very destructive. I used to say to people, when you get out, it's too late. It's too late. If they haven't got this program when they come out the door, they ain't got a prayer. If they haven't had something change in their lives by the time they're in that institution, there's not a prayer. There's not a chance. When you hit them streets, baby, they got bells ringing and cars honking horns at you, streetcars running, girlies by the dozen. You got to go find them dollies. I get people come out of them institutions and say, how come you weren't at the meeting last night? Oh, I went down at the local club down there and drank Cokes and looking for girls. I said, man, have you ever been to an AA meeting? He said, what does that guy do? I said, we got all kinds of girls in Alcoholics Anonymous. Strange. See, I'm tickled to death for one very simple thing, that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that I was affiliated with in Alcoholics Anonymous were going in and out of institutions. And they were carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and letting me go along with them. And I got to go back into the institution that I came out of to talk at an anniversary one night. And when I got through talking, the warden of that institution was standing up hugging me. And we were both crying. I remember one night they allowed me the privilege of going into San Quentin to talk at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went up there and I was all nervous and thing because I walked through the visiting screen, the visiting room where I first saw my daughter. I remember sitting across the table on that visiting screen looking at my wife and my infant daughter, and I looked at my wife, I looked at my infant daughter, and the only thought of my mind was, did she bring $25 to put on the book so I could draw a canteen? I had no feelings or concern for anybody when I was San Quentin. I stood on the stage of that little mess hall, and sitting in the front row of that institution that night was a guy by the name of Louis Nelson, who was the warden in San Quentin at that time. And when I first went to San Quentin in 1951, he was the associate warden, lieutenant in charge of custody. And he made a statement to me as I was sitting in classification committee that day. He said, Johnny, why don't you go out there in that yard and find something to do so you'll always be useful when you get back? That night, I stood and looked down at him and I said, Mr. Nelson, in 1951 you told me to go out in that yard and find something to do so I'd always be useful when I came back to this institution. I said, I found it. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started to cry. And I started to cry, and I blew my whole damn image. I just stood there in front of all them convicts and cried for a half hour. No big, tough, macho stuff going on anymore, baby. I just can't do it no more. If I feel like crying, I'll cry. I found out a very simple thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out that men cry. Men cry, Alcoholics Anonymous. Men care. I wandered through my life running in and out of those institutions, running up and down them streets, and I thought men did certain things. But I didn't ever stop to consider that the people who were telling me that were doubtful of their own manhood. That's why they made those kind of rules. I found out when I hang around with people like you that it's no sin to cry. It's no sin to be concerned about another human being. I found out that the reason I'm sober and safe and sane today is because from time to time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm allowed to take my eyes off of me and put them onto you. And therefore the healing grace takes place in my life. My selfishness and my self-centeredness seems to be my problem. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I'm allowed to work with a newcomer, I'm allowed to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, for that instant, I sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and be more concerned about your life than I am about mine. Every living thing I may ever have in my life, I owe to a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every living thing that's in my life, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. Every living thing I may ever hope to have in my life, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you better believe this. It's a long, long walk from a cell of solitary confinement in San Quentin State Prison to to where I stand today. But for the grace of God, AA, and friends like you, I could have missed it all. Thank you.